is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we are offering five conversations from episode 5. I will look at the role NITs will play in 2024 with Naeem Alkhouri and Ian Rowe. Plus, from the vault, our first discussion of MASEF last summer. This conversation touches on two important subjects: the impact of different potential rare meteorite prices on the size and structure of the treatable mesh population, and the impact GLP-1s are having and will have on clinical trial recruitment and basic patient therapy. The conversation starts with Naeem Alkhouri expressing concern over the yearly $39,000 to $52,000 price that ICER has deemed cost-effective for resmetirom, and expresses preference for a $19,000 price suggested in a different study. This discussion extends into other issues around drug pricing, including the role of PBMs and the pressure for high prices. Separately, Naeem explains how the wider use of GLP-1s has made clinical trial recruiting more challenging. During the conversation, he expresses excitement about two recent papers on survodutide and efruxifermin, new drugs still in pipeline, in terms of their likely impact on aggressive fibrosis. Ian Rowe comes from a different perspective and anticipates high levels of co-prescribing with GLP-1s and resmetirom. He cautions that if resmetirom's price is too high, you may simply see a great deal of GLP-1 use in the UK, at least. He cautions that if resmetirom's price is too high, we might simply see a great deal of GLP-1 use in the UK, at least. After availability of a MASH drug, making proper use of NITs in diagnosing, staging, and tracking patients remains a critical challenge for 2024. There's a great deal to reflect on, and we cover a lot of territory here. So just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Naeem Alkhouri.
One of the biggest factors would be pricing, right? And, how much resmetirom would be priced at on a yearly basis. And, you know, there's that ICER report that said it's cost effective between 39, if I remember correctly, to like 52,000, which in my mind was very high. And there was a recent paper that looked at cost effectiveness. And based on their modeling, they said around 19,000 would be cost effective. So big gap here. But, you know, that's going to be an important deciding factor for us and for payers. The way we're thinking about resmetirom, it's a liver-directed therapy with at least proven anti-fibrotic effects in the phase 3, whereas medications like semaglutide, we did not see that efficacy on fibrosis in the phase 2b. One of the biggest questions already is, you know, how are you going to decide between semaglutide and resmetirom? Although semaglutide does not have the MASH indication, the majority of patients with MASH have an indication for semaglutide. And, we shared a few cases at the meeting also. So if you have someone with F3, heading toward F4, they've been on another GLP-1, let's say they've been on Trulicity, yet they're, progressing in fibrosis stages, probably it's an easy pick to go with resmetirom. But if I have someone that looks like early stage 2 with high BMI 45, uncontrolled diabetes, and their liver stiffness, let's say, is 8.5 kilopascals, do I envision a scenario where I start semaglutide for the obesity or diabetes indication and then repeat my NITs in 6 months and see what happens, and then I can start resmetirom? The hope was that resmetirom would be priced cheaper than semaglutide and tirzepatide, but we'll see what happens. And if it's priced highly, then we're going to be also more selective in the patients that we get started. Obviously, it's not like we have an easy time getting semaglutide and tirzepatide. And unfortunately, sometimes insurance will deny them completely. Like I can tell you in my experience, Medicaid patients in Arizona have no access to weight loss medications, and many commercial insurance also, they will say this is not our preferred drug, so you have to try Trulicity first, or even some older versions of GLP-1s. And it's really not fair, because we know the data, we know the difference in weight loss. So I think these are all scenarios that we're thinking about. I think my colleagues in Europe, you guys have it easy, because we have to do the hard work and then share the experience, and then you pick and choose what you want to implement. And we understand our structure is very different, and our patients sometimes, it's not the same. It's not, a government structure deciding who gets to be treated. We don't have the same leverage negotiating with pharma companies. And I hope things will change for us, but we will start prescribing. I mean, our team is getting ready. The night we get resmetirom approved, I'm going to create an SOP for the team, how we're going to use it, monitor who are the appropriate patients, and how often we need to do labs, when do they need to come back to clinic. So we have a large database, and I think many of our patients will qualify from day one.
Roger Green.
So, Naeem, a thought and a question. Here's the thought. My friends in Europe, my health economist friends in Europe, taught me a long time ago that once you leave the U.S., there is a clear direct relationship between the price of the drug and the size of the patient population that's targeted. Mm-hmm. So there is a population for which 39 to 52 will be cost effective. There is a population at which 19 will be cost effective. Just a wild guess, but the 19 population is going to be a lot larger. And so 39, if they go in the 39 to 52 range, they're immediately shooting at a smaller target population, which is why my ears perked up a couple of weeks ago when Jeff McIntyre said we may only be talking about 300,000-400,000 patients here, because that would line up with that kind of ICER pricing.
No, I mean, I totally agree. At the end of the day, as a doctor, as a healthcare provider, I would love to see the price go down, because whether there is, insurance coverage, that's good or not, someone is paying that price. Unfortunately, more than I do, but we have a crazy system here, and we have all these PBMs that actually they like the drug to be priced higher, and then they like to get the largest rebate because this is how they make more money. And this has been a big issue for us. So it's not only the pharma companies. Actually, sometimes pharma companies want to price the drug lower, but they are pushed by the PBMs to price it higher and then give them higher rebates. And I don't want to get into an area where I'm not an expert, but I would love to hear your thoughts, Roger, on this.
First of all, yes. Okay, my thoughts are really simple. You're right. Okay, you're right. Everything you just said is correct. Okay, the pressure to push prices higher does come from PBMs. And the only issue in which I might not disagree with you, but might have questions, is if you take $90,000 price, I don't know exactly how many patients we're talking about, but it's not clear right now that this system is capable of handling that many patients. Even at the community hepatologist level, do we have enough community hepatologists to handle the inflow at a $19,000 price? I don't know. I'm assuming that work was done, that Madrigal has access to it, and that where they wind up will depend in part on the answer to that question. Number one. Here's my number two. You made a really interesting observation about GLP-1s, which I think is accurate. If you're on Medicaid or if you don't have the money, getting a hold of a GLP-1 right now is challenging. If you have the money, you can pick up the phone, you can call any one of these teledoc services, and they'll prescribe and you can pay. And that can be for somebody trying to lose 15 pounds to fit into a bikini, or it can be to somebody who really needs to make a lifestyle change. I'm wondering how the advent of teledoc GLP-1s completely outside of the electronic medical record system is going to affect anything that you do in terms of your diagnostics, your treatment, anything. And that really is a U.S.-centric question right now, although I'll turn it back to our ex-U.S. colleagues after you answer.
I mean, I can tell you it's affecting us in the clinical trial world already, because many of these trials exclude anyone on a GLP-1. The ones that allow the patients to be on a GLP-1, they want them to be stable for 90 days on the same dose. And sometimes we find a good candidate, we tell them about the trials, they're like, oh, I just started, semaglutide 2 weeks ago. And that means they're on the lowest dose, and now they're going to up titrate every 4 weeks. And then we bring them back after, let's say, 6 months, we think they're going to be stable. But then they tell you, oh, they stopped paying for my semaglutide 2 months ago, and then I just resumed the dose last week. So it's creating these issues. The other thing is, in the context of treating MASH, I mean, a good percentage of patients will respond to semaglutide alone, especially the early F2s. Sometimes we go by liver stiffness as an indicator of presence of significant disease, but the confidence level is not very high. And as they lose weight, that KPA number can drop very quickly to a threshold that looks more like, no significant fibrosis whatsoever. So I think it's going to affect resmetirom, no doubt. And then in 2025, we may get the indication for MASH, latest should be 2026. So that's going to be direct competition then. And I'm not discounting, the possibility that in a large phase 3, semaglutide may have a positive impact on fibrosis regression. Because if you look at their placebo response rate in the phase 2B, it was too high compared to what we got with other programs. So there's still that chance, although we know they don't have any direct effects on the liver, it's mediated by weight loss. We know from lifestyle intervention trials that looked at weight loss that if you lose 10% or more of your total body weight, in one study at least, there's fibrosis regression in 45%. And we know that in the semaglutide trials, about 75% of patients lose 10% or more. So I would suspect that, there's a chance at least that fibrosis may regress in the phase 3.
Thoughts about thoughts for Europe in all this?
Ian Rowe.
Yeah, I've got a few thoughts about it. I mean, the co-prescription or use of semaglutide in this patient population is to be expected. It's a drug that is associated with quality of life and actual benefits, reduction in cardiovascular outcomes, recently published. These are medications that we know do good. And for the patient with multimorbidity that includes obesity and or diabetes, then a lot of the patients, as you say, Naeem, have got existing indications for those. And it's reasonable that those are used first in priority against drugs where there's an idea that there might be benefit, but it's not yet proven. So that, I think, is an important observation. And it's real world. And once Novo Nordisk have sorted out their supply problems and have completely taken over the whole of the GDP of Denmark, then it would be less of an issue. The other thing that I would point out in the cost effectiveness debate is that the price that's being paid for the high-dose semaglutide, the Ozempic in the UK, is commercially sensitive, so it's not disclosed because they've had to provide it at a discount compared to what they wanted to provide it at so that it would come in as cost-effective in the UK, right? And that's a drug that has clear and established benefits. So I think it'd be interesting to see when resmetirom comes to pricing in the UK where it's pitched, but I think that some of the high prices that are being talked about are quite optimistic.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the reviews section of the page from which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're still working on next week's episode, possibly a payer episode, possibly something else. Watch, listen to this space for details. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.